Tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. By this time in the retreat, just kind of notice a sense of having said an awful lot of things. And thinking, well, what else is there that one can say that's new, that's different, that's going to be helpful. And also a sort of slight sense of how much more can you take? realization that we all have our kind of limits. But actually there's not really very much to say anyway, and mostly it's just a matter of variations on a theme: do good, refrain from doing evil, purify the heart, and then the various ways that we can understand this. And it can certainly get very elaborate, these lists upon lists upon lists of these things, that ways of explaining different things, but it's all pointing to pretty much the same kind of thing. So tomorrow, many of you will be leaving. This time tomorrow, this room will be quite desolate, actually. The evening, after a retreat has ended, if one comes into this room, it's always a slightly sad kind of experience. There's all these good-hearted beings are gathered here right now. They're all somewhere else. There's the shrine, and the flowers, slightly wilted, half burnt down candles, piles of notes. Yeah. A bit like the remains after a party, the morning after a party. Well, that's just how it is, isn't it? And you'll be back at home with your families, or some of you perhaps living on your own. And again, perhaps a slight feeling of sadness. Just during these times, you know, although it's incredibly hard a lot of the time, I mean, it's a sense that people go through quite a lot of stuff. And you put in a lot of effort. There's a sort of sense of, and even though we don't talk to each other, there's sort of quite a sense of community, sort of feeling of bonding that happens, a feeling of love, real sense of love, tenderness, affection, concern for one another's welfare. And although, and hopefully one loves one's family, one's children, it takes a little while to settle into that different circumstance. You know, we've shared a lot together during this time. Many hours we've sat together in this room. We've chanted together in the mornings and the evenings. And shared the meal time, tea time, just sitting, drinking, eating silently together. So it takes a little time to settle back in to being with the person that you normally live with, or to being alone, or being with a community that's away from this particular situation. I remember one of the retreats I did with Lumpur, it was the second retreat I'd done with him, and it was actually a very tough retreat for me. I had a sense of really having to put in an enormous amount of effort. And came to the end of the retreat, and just this terrible, terrible feeling of not wanting to leave, this ghastly sense of anguish. And in fact, I was staying with my brother who lives in Oxford. We were at a retreat at Oakenholt, which is just outside Oxford, and so the evening after the retreat had ended, I persuaded my brother to drive me back to Oakenholt, where they were having an evening puja, and just went there just to kind of be around the monks, and hoping to get a glimpse of Ajahn Sumedho. But of course he was resting. So I know what it can be like. As I said before, this phrase, I think it's from Romeo and Juliet, about parting is such sweet sorrow. And I often think that, you know, the reason it's sorrowful is because there has been something very precious, a sense of the beauty and the something very exquisite about a situation of being among people whose commitment is towards that which is totally exquisite, you know, the Dhamma, the truth. Absolutely sublime. There's nothing more beautiful, more perfect than that. And you know, okay, we've all got a little bit to go before we're enlightened, but each one has made effort, has committed themselves to using the structure, using the teachings, to experience this, to taste it. And each one has certainly, I'm quite sure, had moments of tasting something quite beyond perhaps a more mundane reality that we normally live with, a more mundane level of existence. So there's a sense of sorrow of leaving this situation. But the good news is that you never leave the Dhamma, that the Dhamma is always there. This exquisite truth is there for us to turn to at any time. You know, as long as we have a mind and a body, we can taste the Dhamma, we can go for refuge to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. That's always there. So it's not dependent on certain conditions. Certainly this retreat situation is sort of very highly contrived, structured, very carefully thought out situation within which we provide conditions which support awareness. So it's useful to reflect perhaps on what some of these conditions are and the extent to which they can be translated into our daily life away from the monastery, or for those of you who are going to be staying in the monastery, daily life in the monastic community. Just like considering what can we take with us when we go, what of this can we transplant into our regular situation. I'll list some of the things that I find helpful, and some of them may be helpful to some of you, others perhaps not, or maybe not suitable. I find having the presence of a shrine very helpful, or some image of the Buddha. I find that very helpful. Something to turn to each day, you know, like when you first get up in the morning, last thing at night. And if you're in a situation where you're not going to offend people, you know, even bow to it. That's allowed. Candles, incense, flowers. And some of you I know do have shrines in your homes, and this is a very obvious I'm trying to find an appropriate word. Somehow thing doesn't feel quite right. Structure. A very obvious focus. You know, something to focus our awareness, to remind us. To remind us of this possibility, this potential, to remind us of our aspiration, to remind us of our commitment to realizing truth. To remind us of the community that supports that aspiration, that encourages us, that makes us realize that it's possible. And it's not just a sort of empty, wishy-washy wishful thinking. You know, it is something that we can realize and know for ourselves. Something we can manifest in our lives. This truth, this beauty. So we can have a shrine, or we can have pictures or images, perhaps one particular place where we live, a special place that we go to, or perhaps just all over the place, if you have that opportunity. We've got Buddha images all over the place in this monastery. Lots and lots of them, and pictures of wise teachers, Ajahn Chah, and Sumedho, other wise teachers whose example we try to follow. Some people have little Buddha rupas in their cars. Other people have like the Sangha calendar on their desk at work. A good talking point. Each month there's a little kind of quotation that Ajahn Mininda has found and connected with an image that reminds us again of these truths of our human existence. We can chant, perhaps, or even just recollect. He used the recollections of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the recollections, the five subjects for frequent recollection. I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, and so on. Just contemplating the importance of living carefully. If we live carefully, we can expect to have a sense of a wholesome result. Like if we cultivate wholesome conditions, then there are wholesome results for ourselves and for others. We were contemplating the Eightfold Path yesterday and got as far as right action, perfect action. These words kusala and akusala, which are generally translated as skillful and unskillful. And they're rated according to the result. You know, that unskillful intention, unskillful thinking, unskillful speech, unskillful action brings an unfortunate result. We might get some immediate gratification, but in our quieter moments when we sit in meditation and we reflect on our life, we tend to not feel very good about it. You know, for example, just going through some extreme of sensual indulgence, you know, being really, really gluttonous or promiscuous or indulgent in some way, or being really unkind, you know, when we feel angry or upset. Just doing or saying something really mean. And as our practice goes on, even if it's just mildly mean, we don't actually get away with it. It lodges in the heart, this painful feeling that we've engendered, that we've created through this unskillful speech or action. Sometimes in the community, if you're feeling a bit grumpy, you know, a bit irritated with somebody, you know, sometimes, you know, I might just look at somebody in a slightly unkind way, you know, sort of a bit of a mean glance. And then if they don't show up for puja, I feel terrible. Like, oh dear. Are they all right? This kind of horror or dread of, say, breaking the precepts, doing something wrong. Not because we're frightened of getting punished by somebody outside, but more because we have to live with the memory, with the consequences. As I think I've said before, of course there are times that we make mistakes, of course at the times that we're heedless, you know, that we perhaps touching a little bit on what some of you has come up at different times, you know, perhaps if you're overtired, just pushed yourself too far. That's right, today someone was talking about just taking on other people's suffering, you know, like those of you who are in the caring professions, or who have to deal with people a lot. You know, if you're in some kind of big organization where you have responsibility for many, many people, and there's all day long people coming and asking you this or that or the other, and, you know, this can be very, very exhausting. And it's really important to actually be conscious of that, to be aware of that. Sometimes we're in a situation where we just have to keep doing it. So we have to be particularly mindful. It's like driving in thick fog or snow and sleet. You know, we're aware that the conditions are quite dangerous, that we could very easily let fly at somebody or do something unskillful, unfortunate. And so we just, at times like that, we take particular care. And then as soon as possible, get out to a park, or get out to the countryside, sit under a tree, just sit on a bench and stare into space for half an hour. It's very, very therapeutic. Not meditating, just sitting, just enjoying the feeling of just sitting in a state of complete exhaustion, utter fed up, full up with people, and just being alone and just feeling what you're feeling. And then after quite a short time you feel okay again. you can carry on. We need to learn to be attentive to our own needs. I mean, it's a beautiful aspiration to want to help everybody else and to take away all the suffering on planet Earth. It's wonderful, but it's utterly impossible. we don't actually have that capacity. We have the capacity to take away our own suffering. This we can do. We can free our own hearts. But as far as getting to the end of suffering out there, there's no way. And I don't mean this to depress. I don't mean this as a kind of pessimistic, dismal. It's not a pessimistic, dismal kind of message. But rather an encouragement to just shift the focus a little bit. When I finally twigged that the amount of good things I could do to make life better was actually infinite, no matter how much I did, there'd always be more to do. I shifted from trying to get the job done, trying to clear up the mess out there, to, because we tend to think, well, if once we've done that, then we can stop and have a rest. At least that's the way my mind goes. I'll just do this, this, and this, and when I've done that, then I'll have a rest. So I'll just sort out this person's problem and that person's problem, and I'll tidy up this mess, and I'll do that. And then you suddenly realize, no, there's always going to be more things to do. So how do we decide when to stop if there's always more to do? Where do we draw the line? Well, what I've found is helpful is to just actually, instead of thinking at all about what's happening out there, is to tune into this one. And to draw the line just a little bit before one is totally exhausted. You know, you do a bit, and maybe another bit, and then you start to realize that actually your energy's going down quite a lot. And maybe you need to do something for this one. And community life is marvellous for this, because there's always things to do, always people to help. And at first we can get a kind of, well, there's a tremendous amount of, like, pleasure in this. It's almost a kind of greed, I realised, myself. You know, just taking on more and more things, good things to be doing. And sometimes it reminded me of, like, when you've been shopping and you've just got so many things to carry that you can only just about manage to carry them and get them to your car or wherever it is you're going, and usually you manage to drop something on the way. There's this feeling of just too much, but a kind of buzz, a kind of the tremendous sort of gratification out of all of this, which, you know, is partly wholesome, but partly, as I began to look into it more closely, there's a slight sort of flavour of bhava tanha, or bhavasava, that Venerable Suvatra was talking about the other evening, this kind of becoming energy. And then of course one gets completely exhausted and grumpy and sick and has to have a holiday to recover. So how can we sustain our life, you know, particularly life of service? How can we sustain it without reaching this burnout point? As I said, by shifting the focus to this being. This being is just as much a part of the universe as all of the beings out there. This being is just as worthy of care. This being suffering needs just as much attention as everybody else is suffering. And sometimes it's difficult to really appreciate that. And this being suffering is certainly one lot of suffering one can do something about. So we attend to it. Giving it a drink of water when it's thirsty. One of the things about this time together has been that our life has been very much simplified. Those of you who've come from your home situation, I can imagine that the things that you have with you are perhaps maybe at most a quarter, but perhaps maybe just a tenth or a twentieth of all of your possessions. Well, you maybe brought a couple of pairs of shoes and a few pullovers and, you know, odd change of clothing. But probably what you left at home was much more, you know, wardrobes and dozens of, well, maybe not dozens, but lots and lots of pairs of shoes and all kinds of, well, books, zillions of books, and beautiful objects, bits of furniture, carpets, knick-knacks of one kind or another. And then your diary, absolutely chock-a-block, full of things that to go back to. Going out to dinner, going out to the cinema, going out to concerts, meeting so-and-so for coffee, this huge, long, big social agenda. I mean, maybe you don't, but this is just, I'm just speculating. All these things to do during this retreat time. We've lived quite simply, with just just what we need. Like you probably before you came, you thought, well, what am I going to need for my time at the monastery on retreat? And you probably thought, well, Amarawati, it's usually cold and it'll probably rain. So I need things to protect me and keep me warm. And they probably won't let us read, so I won't bother about bringing any books. And I'll leave my TV behind. And then having arrived, you know, what's the thing to do? Get up in the morning, clean your teeth, get dressed, come to the shrine room, do the chanting, meditate, sit, breathe in, breathe out for a bit, get up, go and have breakfast, good breakfast, and probably quite a choice of things to have. Shall I have tea, or shall I have coffee, or shall I have barley cup? There've been a few choices that you've had to make. Doing the chores, coming to the shrine room, sit. Oh, qigong, beg your pardon, qigong. Then sit, then walk, then eat. The day's been very simple. And at first I suspect that this simple structure, this simple day, was actually quite hard, quite boring, quite miserable. But little by little, as the mind became simple also, as the mind kind of caught up with what was happening, or settled down, relaxed into it, I imagine that you probably find it quite pleasant, not having to talk to anybody, quite nice. Quite nice just to breathe in and then breathe out again. Just to walk up and down, just to watch the changing light, the sky, the trees. Quite pleasant. So simplicity is another quality that we can consider in relation to our situation away from the monastery. Just really considering what you have, what you surround yourself with, and considering the kind of activities that you engage with. You know, are all these things that I have really necessary? Are all these things that I do really necessary? It may be that the answer is yes. But at least to review, to take stock. One of the things I've noticed in my 53 years of experience of life is a certain I don't know if I'd call it a natural law, but something approaching a law, which is basically just the law of accumulation. Which is, well, this is my understanding, this is what I've noticed and how I interpret it, is that unless one makes a conscious effort not to accumulate, accumulation just happens. Things just seem to kind of come. You know, just bits of paper, like things sort of come through the letterbox. Just bits of paper, things are encouraging you to get more possessions, so then possessions start coming, people start giving you things. You know, even living a mendicant life, like supposed to be utterly simple, our existence, I still have the same phenomenon, just things. And maybe our things are kind of simpler, like I accumulate sort of plastic bags. Plastic bags and sort of containers. But it's the same principle. And then things to do. You know, I've at last begun to develop the practice of saying no. But it's taken me a long, long time to get to this point where, you know, I can actually say no without feeling guilty or without feeling resentful. And these are the two things that can happen. You know, you just feel totally overburdened, you know, you just, and somebody, you know, finally the last straw, somebody asks you to do something very small and you just say, no! You know, because you just can't bear to do another thing. And then you feel terrible. Or else, you know, to be able to actually say no and not, you know, when you haven't reached that point, and not feel guilty about it, not feel that you're letting somebody down. It's funny, isn't it, the kind of pressure that we put on ourselves. And we don't actually realize that we're the ones that are putting it on ourselves. We think that everybody else is, or there's some kind of vague, sort of shadowy something or other, like the personification of duty, that is just kind of there, the sort of shadow, that we never stop to question. And we just kind of blindly keep on kind of picking up more and more good things to do and gathering more and more things around us. I was very, I felt rather uncomfortable, I have to say, when one of the monks who'd been spending some time in the community from Thailand, a very, very lovely monk, somebody that who I enjoyed having in the community, and he was about to go back to Thailand, and you know, I said, oh, can't you stay? It'd be really nice if you could stay. And he'd made some commitment to do something in Thailand, and he said to me, he said, you know, the ball's in your court. You know, what you do, where you go, if you go anywhere, or if you just stay here and be a dutiful nun, which is kind of what I'd assumed that I would do. And there was something quite, yes, I said, it made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. It was a reality I didn't particularly want to take on board. Just the fact that I had to take responsibility for my own life. That I had a choice. And I had to realize that I had a choice. I couldn't just blame it all on this kind of shadowy sort of sense of duty that was just there in the background all the time, making me feel I had to do all these things. And then sort of ending up feeling rather exhausted. Not much joy. Very little joy. I remember the kind of a satisfaction. And I certainly had a sense of joy that I was living this life, but I kind of felt I hadn't actually got it yet. It was like, I used to kind of get haunted by this verse, a song from the Incredible String Band. Some of you are the same generation. The Hedgehog song. Yes? Yeah, something like, you know all the words, and you sing all the songs, but you never quite learned the song she sang. Is that right? She sang. Yeah, you know all the words and you sung all the notes, but you never quite learned the song she sang. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learned the song. And I used to think about this a lot, but I hadn't quite got it. I didn't quite get it. And it wasn't until I realized that life could end at any time. It was through quite an extreme situation where life almost did end. I finally twigged. that this life is a very, very precious opportunity. Realize that this life is a very precious opportunity, and that one of the saddest things would be to live it and to reach the end of one's life and realize that one hadn't actually really chosen to do what one had done, that one had always just moved along just because this is how things were working out. Out of a sense of duty, a sense of responsibility, without actually really seeing what one's true responsibility is, without actually ever really questioning, you know, what is my responsibility? What is the meaning of life? What's it all about? You know, is it about kind of propping up some institution, doing one's duty, you know, sacrificing oneself for the welfare of others? I'm saying that in a kind of slightly negative, sarcastic way, by the way, so just get this right. You know, is that what it's about? Certainly it's not about selfish indulgence either. You know, just getting the maximum pleasure, even at the expense of others. So like these are the two extremes. You know, total self-sacrifice without any regard for this being here. Or total disregard of everybody else, sacrificing everybody else for this one's pleasure. Of course, it's neither of these, is it? The Buddha talked about the middle way between these extremes. Having a regard for all of creation, not just either this one here, nor all of them out there, but having equal regard for all humanity, so that one cares for it all. One loves and cherishes this one just as much as one loves and cherishes those around us. One cares for this one just as much as one cares for those around us. So part of caring for this one is what we've been doing this last 10 days. trying to understand why life is so difficult. Yeah. Why is life so difficult? Why do we suffer so much? Where are we going wrong? What's happening? Unfortunately, the Buddha presented us with a teaching that showed us precisely what we're doing wrong, precisely why there's so much suffering, and also presented a teaching that showed us how we can find the way out of that, how we can live in a way that brings an increasing sense of ease and happiness and well-being, both for ourselves and for those around us. Years ago, when I was at boarding school with Mother Rosemary, I went through a very, very devout phase. I was very, very devout. I was on the library committee, and I was given the religious section of the library, which is actually quite a small section. And in this section was a book called School for Prayer by Olive Wyon, which for some reason I took off the shelf and began reading. And I used to, like, after they used to put the lights out at a certain time, you know, every year you got a little bit later before the lights went out. And when the lights went out, you were supposed to stop talking or doing any, you know, anything other than resting. And after the lights went out, I remember I was in one of the dormitories upstairs with, I don't know, four or five other, I suppose, 14, 15 year olds. And after lights out, I used to get my School for Prayer, my Bible, and creep out. There was a very large loo up on that landing, and I used to go into this big loo and put the light on and sit and read these books and pray. And it was special kind of a deep sense of peace and, you know, mystical experiences, I suppose you'd say. I can't remember why I began that story. Oh dear. The meaning of life. Oh, that's right. Got it. And I had a little book, and I used to write things down in it. And one time I wrote down something about wanting to really make use of this life, this body, this incarnation, however we'll call it, for the just to try and make the world a better place. It was a kind of dedication, really. That was when I was about 14. It was just this very strong feeling of wanting to somehow make the world a better place. And then I went through my rebellious phase and kind of chucked the whole thing over. Got a boyfriend, went to university, did all kinds of things that I slightly regret. And then began to realize the suffering that was going on, the difficulties of having a mind, having a body, having desire, wanting to be happy, basically, and not always being very happy, and not knowing how to find happiness. Wanting to experience life, there was certainly plenty of that, but not really knowing how to be happy. And so I began meditation. Then I got into the caring professions and I worked in psychiatry, but realized that unless I could really understand my own suffering, I wasn't really going to be able to help anybody very much with theirs, much as I wanted to. I had all kinds of good intentions, but not much of a clue how to really offer anything of substance or value. And eventually realized that I had to really come to an understanding myself and find something of value, something that would work, some kind of medicine that I could use to heal myself, and then I might be able to offer something. So when I had this experience of being so ill, I actually, you know, thought about, well, you know, what would I really regret not having done when the time of death comes? And you know, I felt quite content really about the way my life had gone in many ways. But I thought, well, if I get to the end of my life and haven't really enjoyed it, that would feel sad. That would feel unfortunate. And haven't really made use of this opportunity and found joy and delight. Haven't really actually chosen to do what I do, you know, rather than just, as I said, finding oneself with this spectre of duty hovering in the background that one just submitted to continuously. It became obvious to me that my duty as a religious person was to be happy, was to enjoy life, was to be peaceful, was to be at ease. But this is like the fulfillment of the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha's teachings were given for our welfare and happiness. And if I couldn't use them for my welfare and happiness, then I wasn't actually a very good example. I wasn't really a very good representative of the Buddha. Wasn't really a good disciple. You know, I hadn't actually quite got it. And so I began to contemplate, well, what brings welfare? What brings a sense of happiness and ease? And much of it is about just really contemplating the goodness of one's life. Taking care of oneself. And there were some other things that I thought, if I die with these things uncompleted, that would be a shame. So I took care of those too. Just like, for example, you know, certain people who've really helped me in my life, just to be able to acknowledge that, you know, to write to them and say, yeah, I'm really grateful for how you helped me. Or people that I might have hurt, and write to them and say, you know, I really feel, please forgive me for my insensitivity or the things that I did that caused you unhappiness. Just like setting things straight, clearing one's desk, as I said the other evening. These things are important because we never know, you know, when it's going to happen to us. We know that it will happen to us. This is one thing that is absolutely certain. But we never know quite when. We never know how long we've got. So this reflection is really just an encouragement to just take care of life as you go along. Don't put it off. Not in a panicky, frightened, agitated way, but just, you know, okay, what would I regret not doing? And then take steps to do it, you know, whenever it's convenient. Yes. It may be that your circumstances don't allow you to attend to it straight away. Maybe you have to wait a bit. Maybe it'll never be possible. But at least you've kind of taken it on board. You've taken responsibility for your aspiration, for your longing. I was very delighted talking to a friend of the community who hadn't seen for some time, and he said he'd just been for a holiday to Antarctica. I thought, gosh, that's a strange thing to do. But this was something he'd always wanted to do.
So he went to Antarctica.
Had a great time. So it's like just regularly taking stock of one's life, of one's situation. And seeing how one feels about different aspects of it. Just questioning, is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay? You know, am I okay with this? Is there something I can do to change this? Have I really chosen to do this? Can I really take responsibility? Have I really taken responsibility for this situation that I find myself in? Is there a choice? Rather than just accumulating these kind of sort of subliminal grudges or resentment of one kind or another, just a feeling of bitterness, a slightly sour, sad feeling, when we feel that, you know, we haven't really had the choice, and it's all because of them. I had to do this. Wonderful story in we've been the sort of the latest monastic fad is a particular video of Marshall Rosenberg, who advocates something called non-violent communication, and we've all been watching these videos of non-violent communication. There's one scene of where he talks about people who claim that they have to do things. And there was one woman who's apparently in the audience who said, but, you know, that there are some things that you have to do. And so he said, well, you know, give me an example. He said, well, I have to, when I leave this workshop, I have to go home and I have to cook dinner. And I hate it. I hate it with a passion. And so he kind of looked at her and kind of challenged her, and she decided that maybe she would surprise her family. And so she went home and she said, I'm not going to cook dinner anymore. I hate it. And so some weeks later, I think her son, who went and spoke with this person who'd been leading the workshop, and he said to her, to her son, he said, well, you know, how was it when your mother announced that she wasn't going to cook dinner anymore? And the son said, he said, well, you know, we just felt, thank God. Every evening she cooks the dinner, and then all through dinner she complains. She expresses her resentment about it. This is a very good example, isn't it? We make these assumptions about the things that we have to do without ever really questioning, without ever really considering, you know, will the whole world fall apart if we don't do this? Or if we do this, you know, if we do have this conversation with somebody who's been driving us nuts for the last 10 years, you know, if we actually sit down and talk to them about it, maybe we'll find it's all right. And if we set up the conditions for admonishment or having a frank dialogue with somebody, you know, maybe we'll find it's all right. Maybe it'll be a relief for them. Finally, the air is clear. Yeah. I'm sure maybe for all of us there are conversations that still need to be had, and maybe we should try not to put them off for too many more decades, too many more years. Conversations expressing appreciation, expressing tenderness, expressing love. And maybe we just assume that people know that we love them. But have we actually told them? And then the other conversations actually letting people know if things that they're doing are really, really difficult for us. Can we do that? Or are we going to put that conversation off for another 10 years and carry on allowing this kind of irritation to gnaw away at us, diminishing our sense of well-being, just draining it away year by year? This phrase in the sharing of blessings chant, may harmful influences not weaken my efforts, may the forces of delusion not take hold nor weaken my resolve. This is the different ways that we allow ourselves to be undermined, just through the subtle kind of unwholesome conditions that just creep into consciousness. We're barely aware of them, and as soon as we notice them, we push them down because we think that's not being a good Buddhist, that's not being a good person. We should be sweet and kind and loving and generous, rather than actually just really saying, what's really going on here? What's happening? And allowing these little voices to show themselves, these beings, these miserable little beings lurking in the back of our consciousness, bring them into the foreground. Show them a bit of concern. Listen to them. A little bit of metta. Things go better with metta. You'd be amazed at the increase in the sense of well-being and happiness as you begin to allow these things into consciousness. Let them be heard. And then they can go. They only kind of gnaw away as long as we don't actually pay attention to them. That's all they're asking for. So really, you know, use this time for really taking stock. You know, what's really important? What really matters in my life as a human being? What do I really want to do with it? What would I regret not having done? Are there things I can change? Are there ways that I can live more happily? Or am I able, quite honestly and wholeheartedly, simply to rejoice in the situation that I have, the way that my life is? You know, it may be that for some of you this is the answer. You know, that yes, I'm really content with my relationship. It's something that's vibrant, that's alive. My home situation is fine, my work situation is fine. You know, I really hope that is the case for you. But if it's not, then really just look. How can I really take responsibility for how it is? Can I really consider ways that things could be altered, ways that things could be different, that would be more fulfilling, bring more of a sense of well-being and gladness into my heart? Because it's only when we have a sense of well-being and gladness that we can really benefit others very much. If everything that we do is from a sense of duty, or a mild sense of just sort of feeling a bit bitter and resentful about it, then that's not going to bring a very happy result. You know, all the people that we're trying to help, they'll pick up on it straight away. They'll feel that they're a burden. They'll feel that they're a nuisance. Do we really want to make people feel like that? And can we do it from a place of free will? You know, a place of well-being, so that we've actually filled up our own heart with this sense of well-being, so it just naturally flows out, rather than just kind of wringing the last ounce of well-being out of a sort of poor, parched little heart. And sometimes it feels like that, doesn't it? And when it's like that, we really need to take stock and think, you know, what can we do to bring a sense of well-being, this full, overflowing heart of well-being, happiness. And just each one of you spending the time that you have here is, and that's something I would definitely recommend, you know, just to regularly drench your whole being with goodness. And just coming to a situation where you can really contemplate these teachings, really recollect what is wholesome, what upholds a sense of dignity, self-respect, well-being, these qualities. And then to consider means in your own life, daily life, how you can maintain that as far as possible. Daily practice of meditation, recollection, contemplation, from time to time getting together with others, either in the monastery or in a group, or even just setting aside a day for day retreat, even just on your own at home, or half a day retreat, listening to tapes, reading Dhamma books, practicing meditation. These are all things that one can use, ways of nourishing the heart. Practicing according to the precepts, practicing generosity, dana, according to our means, either materially or time, energy, attention. Like often just really, as I was saying earlier, just like cultivating the quality of listening, you know, really being able to be present for another person, to really listen to them. You know, if they're in trouble of some kind or another. It's like an incredible act of generosity. You're just taking 10 minutes, 20 minutes, just to really attend and to bear witness to their suffering, their difficulty. And knowing that one's doing this as much for one's own well-being as for theirs. So I offer these reflections for your contemplation this evening.
Let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless truth, the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. by this time in the retreat. Just kind of notice a sense of having said an awful lot of things. And so thinking, well, what else is there that one can say that's new, that's different, that's going to be helpful, and also a sort of slight sense of how much more can you take? realization that we all have our kind of limits. But actually there's not really very much to say anyway, and mostly it's just a matter of variations on a theme: do good, refrain from doing evil, purify the heart, and then the various ways that we can understand this. And it can certainly get very elaborate, these lists upon lists upon lists of these things, that ways of explaining different things. But it's all pointing to pretty much the same kind of thing. So tomorrow, many of you will be leaving. This time tomorrow, this room will be quite desolate, actually. The evening after a retreat has ended, if one comes into this room, it's always a slightly sad kind of experience. There's all these good-hearted beings are gathered here right now. They're all somewhere else. There's the shrine, flowers, slightly wilted, half burnt down candles, piles of notes. A bit like the remains after a party, the morning after a party. Well, that's just how it is, isn't it? And you'll be back at home with your families, or some of you perhaps living on your own. And again, perhaps a slight feeling of sadness. It's during these times, you know, although it's incredibly hard a lot of the time, I mean, it's a sense that people go through quite a lot of stuff. And put in a lot of effort. There's a sort of sense of, and even though we don't talk to each other, there's quite a sense of community, sort of feeling of bonding that happens, a feeling of love, real sense of love, tenderness, affection, concern for one another's welfare. And although, and hopefully one loves one's family, one's children, it takes a little while to settle into that different circumstance. You know, we've shared a lot together during this time. Many hours we've sat together in this room. We've chanted together in the mornings and the evenings. And shared the meal time, tea time. Just sitting, drinking, eating silently together. So it takes a little time to settle back in to being with the person that you normally live with, or to being alone, or being with a community that's away from this particular situation. I remember one of the retreats I did with Lumpur. It was the second retreat I'd done with him, and it was actually a very tough retreat for me. I had a sense of really having to put in an enormous amount of effort, and it came to the end of the retreat, and just this terrible, terrible feeling of not wanting to leave, this ghastly sense of anguish. And in fact, I was staying with my brother who lives in Oxford. We were at a retreat at Oakenholt, which is just outside Oxford. And so the evening after the retreat had ended, I persuaded my brother to drive me back to Oakenholt, where they were having an evening puja, and just went there just to kind of be around the monks, and hoping to get a glimpse of Ajahn Sumedho. But of course he was resting. So I know what it can be like. As I said before, this phrase, I think it's from Romeo and Juliet, about parting is such sweet sorrow. And I often think that, you know, the reason it's sorrowful is because there has been something very precious, a sense of the beauty and the something very exquisite about a situation of being among people whose commitment is towards that which is totally exquisite, you know, the Dhamma, the truth. Absolutely sublime. It's nothing more beautiful, more perfect than that. And you know, okay, we've all got a little bit to go before we're enlightened, but each one has made effort, has committed themselves to using the structure, using the teachings, to experience this, to taste it. And each one has certainly, I'm quite sure, had moments of tasting something quite beyond perhaps a more mundane reality that we normally live with, a more mundane level of existence. So there's a sense of sorrow leaving this situation, but the good news is that you never leave the Dhamma. That the Dhamma is always there. This exquisite truth.